Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Language, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating, and today we'll be talking to Marco Ferrante, author of Indian Perspectives on Consciousness, Language, and the Self, The School of Recognition on Linguistics and Philosophy of Mind, published as part of the Routledge Hindu series in August 2020. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Malcolm, and hello and hi to the listeners.
So, we're going to be talking about a few different intertwined topics on the podcast today. You talk about consciousness, about language, and also the metaphysical status of the self. But now this is the language channel, so I'm going to start with the topic of language and we'll work our way through the other topics as they're interconnected. Let's start at a high level. You're looking at two philosophers, Utpala Deva and Abhinavagupta. What is the main idea that they have about the relationship between language, consciousness, and the self? What are they arguing for?
Okay. So, very broadly, the main idea of the book is that these ancient Indian philosophers that I examine and in it, that is to say Utpala Deva, Abhinavagupta, and also Bhartrihari, who lived a little bit earlier than the other two, So all these philosophers more or less argue that one cannot properly cognize or be conscious of anything without the existence of a language. Now, in a nutshell, their main idea is that in order to be conscious, first one has to know something. Then in order to know, one has to act. But in order to act, and this is the important point, one needs a coordination of mental states, which is possible, according to them, only through an overarching activity of the mind that is conceptual. And the idea of conceptuality, at least within classical Indian philosophy, is almost always associated with language. So I would say that most of the book circles around the relationship between consciousness and language. But as you said, it is also true that at least Utpala Deva and Abhinavagupta, they explicitly argue that if there is consciousness, then there must be someone who is conscious of, that is to say, a self. And this is, of course, I mean, it's not banal, as it may sound at first upon first hearing, but it is quite compelling because one can defend the notion of consciousness without entailing the existence of a subject of experience. And this is clearly demonstrated by all sorts of Buddhist philosophies, in classical India, for instance. But the defense of the existence of this subject of experience from the criticism of Buddhism is precisely the ultimate purpose of Utpala Deva and Abhinavagupta's work. But also Bhartrihari, even if he's less interested in this apologetic dimension, we could say, as a Hindu Brahmanical author, accepts the existence of a self, of a subject of experience. So this is more or less the big picture, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what got you interested in these thinkers, Utpala Deva, Abhinavagupta, and Bhartrihari?
Oh, yes, this is a good question. which is, I mean, I could answer partly biographically and partly, considering what I have done in the last year. So my interest in Upaladev and Abhinavagupta, so in the Pratyabhidnya school in general, so the school of recognition, stretches back to my university years. I had the privilege to study Sanskrit and Indian philosophy in Rome, in Italy, with Raffaele Torella, who is a world-leading expert on this, on the Pratyabhidnya school, basically. So I'm familiar with the themes of the school since quite a long time, and since the very beginning of my career as student, which is not, did not take place yesterday, unfortunately. So to this sort of main biographical aspect, one may add that my work has often focused on the work of Bhartrihari, who is a 5th century linguist and philosopher who gave enormous, I would say, contributions to the study of language in classical India. So the point is that Bhartrihari is often quoted and discussed and taken as model by Upaladeva and Abhinavagupta. So at one point in my career, I was allowed the opportunity to spend some time working on the relationship between these two sides. And at first, the idea was to study the historical and philological relationship between Bhartrihari and Upaladeva and Abhinavagupta, so the Pratyabhidnya holders. Then, in time, I think that the work became much more philosophy-oriented and came to take the form of the book that we are discussing now, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the book, it includes philological aspects, of course, because you're working with these texts and you have to think about questions of texts and priority between authors and things. But really, one of the things you're doing in the book is trying to understand their ideas as philosophers and engage philosophically with them and bringing in things from analytic philosophy and contemporary philosophy as well. Yeah. Good. So let's talk about that then. So you're trying to bring Indian philosophy, these thinkers who are writing between the 5th and the 10th centuries, you know, in the Common Era, into conversation with contemporary analytic philosophers of language and as well as mind. And you mentioned that this is a place that you came to in writing the book. How do you engage this way when people might say that these are very different traditions, they're starting with different languages, different contexts, maybe even different questions and presuppositions? How are you bringing them in contact with one another?
Yeah, thank you very much, because this is a really important point. Before answering that, just give me 2 minutes to, or even 1 minute, to specify what we are talking about, because to better understand the relationship between these traditions and contemporary philosophy of mind. So the School of the Recognition is a tantric Shaiva school that thrived in Kashmir around the end of the first millennium of the Common Era. So their basic doctrine is a form of non-dualism or monism, if you want, since they believed that the whole reality is nothing but an expansion of consciousness, more specifically of Shiva's consciousness. So human's purpose in life is comes down to recognize this fact and to become one with Shiva himself, in a way. So the three main holders of the school, which are Somananda, which is less important in the book, and then Upaladeva and Abhinavagupta. Among these three, probably the most interesting one and the theoretician of the school was the second, Utpala, who was the holder of the basic text of the tradition, so the stanzas of the Recognition of the Lord, a work that was later on commented by the great Abhinavagupta, who was one of the most important intellectuals of classical India in general, a real polymath, and who probably was a disciple of Utpaladeva. So, and this intervening master was named probably Lakshmana Gupta, even if he didn't leave behind any work. So this is more or less the context of the school. And then, as you rightly said, I've tried to approach this, these authors from the point of view, I mean, also using concepts and ideas of contemporary analytic philosophy. So the question is, actually, can we really do these things? Can we do this sort of comparative philosophy? Well, some would say that it is absolutely impossible. Well, others would argue that with precautions, with care, we can compare doctrines of authors belonging to different ages and different civilizations. Now, since we are talking about a book that mostly does comparative philosophy, it should be already clear what is my opinion on the issue.
Right.
Now, I definitely think that comparative philosophy is legitimate, and that by practicing it, we can learn something different from what we would gather from no comparing or from comparing works and authors between the same culture. That is what we usually do in Euro-American philosophy. But it is nevertheless useful to consider at least a couple of one objection to the very possibility of comparative philosophy. And this objection is that we can't do comparative philosophy because by doing so we are simply, in a way, projecting our Euro-American conceptions and ideas onto other cultures, thus practicing some form of cultural colonialism, and in that way overlooking historical differences. This is a good objection, I think, and the point is how to reply. Well, a first answer could be, when we talk about Euro-American philosophy, we are not talking about a monolithic entity. We are talking about a collection of quite often conflicting views. It is certainly true that one is applying one's own personal worldview when dealing with other cultures, with other civilization, and certainly we should make an effort to minimize the biases that we have. Even if I think that it's quite almost impossible to eliminate all of them. The second, objection, this time more philosophical in a way, more substantial, is that Euro-American and Indian philosophies embody alien cultural paradigms that are impossible to reconcile. And this would be based on the idea that different paradigms are incommensurable, an idea that is, deeply influenced by the now classic work of Thomas Kuhn on scientific paradigms. This is, of course, debatable. To be more specific, I have discussed in some detail at the beginning of the book the way in which Kuhn's arguments are refuted by Donald Davidson on this point, on the point of incommensurability. So I encourage readers and listeners to have a look at the way in which this incommensurability perspective can be tackled in a way. More specifically, and just to finish my answer, what have I done to avoid these charges, these possible problems, because they are problems? In one word, I have tried to contextualize as much as I could. So all that I say in the book is based on a first-hand experience of the works I'm examining. Then, of course, everything I say can be criticized, refuted, lambasted. But I've tried to ground my interpretations of the doctrines of these philosophers sticking to the texts.
Right, right. And you're doing that on both sides, you might say. You're looking at the explicit views of particular analytic philosophers, as well as the views of Indian philosophers, arguing that they're both doing philosophy. So yeah, I would encourage readers to take a look at the discussion of methodology if they're interested in that. Let's dig into the details though of the what you're calling the doctrines or their views. So you mentioned Shiva, and you mentioned that Shiva is important for, in particular, Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta in terms of the self. Can you expand a little bit on this? Why is the status of the self so important for them, thinking here in particular about Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta. And why do they think that language is so important in understanding at the self? You hinted at this earlier. Let's dig in a little bit more.
Yes. So the status of self is absolutely crucial for the philosophy of the recognition for the Pratyabhijna school, essentially for two main reasons. The first, if you want, is a little bit more religion-oriented. The second one, more philosophically interesting. Now, the first, the more religion-oriented, is that the self, which is intended by these thinkers as pure freedom to act, is, as I quickly mentioned before, the embodiment of Shiva himself. So liberation, which is crucial for these philosophers, as it is for most classical Indian holders, and liberation is the liberation, the release from the cycle of births. So liberation comes about when one realizes that there is no difference at all between one's own consciousness and the universal consciousness that is identified with the deity in question, with Shiva. Now, one thing that I think it's important to underline is that this idea of identification between a universal consciousness and an individual one looks quite similar to the ancient Upanishadic notion, which is quite well known even in the Western culture, you could say, whereby our inner self, Atman, is to be identified with the cosmic principle, Brahman, a notion that is, besides being known also outside the restricted circle of specialists of Indian philosophy, is also the basis of the entire Advaita Vedanta's philosophy, for instance, probably the most famous darshana or philosophical school of classical India in outside India. Well, the Shaiva's notion, so the Pratyabhijna notion of this identification between personal self and universal consciousness is actually rather different. So for them, liberation is not produced when one discovers oneself as identical to the universal consciousness. But once having immersed oneself in this consciousness, one is capable to disengage and re-engage with this consciousness at his own will, basically. So you must be able to go up and down in a way. So liberation is intended here quite dynamically, and it consists in freedom of action. I have to quote, and in regard to this, my teacher, Raffaele Torella, was used to say, for these philosophers, liberation does not consist in being able to reach the highest step of a ladder, but rather to reach the highest step and being able to return to the lowest step at will. Now, this notion is, of course, strongly influenced by the religious beliefs of these others, with Paladeva and Abhinavagupta, I mean, who were, besides being a quite sophisticated philosopher, they were tantric gurus, tantric masters. Mm-hmm. So you asked me about the role of language. From this religious, in a way, perspective, language was seen as a creative aspect of the subject that was inevitably associated with the self. This is the first, in a way, reason why the self is so important for these philosophers. Then there is a second reason, a more argumentative one, that is, of course, connected with the previous one. And the centrality of the discussion of self in these works, in the works of Abhinavagupta and Utpaladeva, is due to the necessity these philosophers felt to answer the criticism of the notion of self that was advanced by the Buddhists historically. And so Buddhists are very important, actually, in defining the philosophical identity of the school of the recognition. First, because they were their main opponents, but also, and this is quite subtle, also because they were a source of philosophical notions that the Shaiva thinkers were able to adapt and reuse in a new context and to use them against their original supporters, in a way. And that's another quite interesting aspect of this, of this philosophy.
So they're concerned with the no-self view of the Buddhists, in other words, there. And when we were thinking here about which Buddhists were concerned with what you might call the epistemology school or the Pramanavada, and so these are the Buddhists that they're in engaging with primarily, so Dignaga, Dharmakirti. And so can you say just a little bit more about then why language is important in their arguments here in response to these Pramanavadins or these epistemological thinkers?
So the point is that there is a complete different understanding of the role of language between the Buddhist thinkers that you have just mentioned. So Dignaga and Dharmakirti and the entire school, the logical epistemological school of Buddhism, and that of the Pratyabhijna authors, quite influenced in this respect by Bhartrihari himself. So, whereas for the Buddhist epistemologists, language was connected to one of the two main ways to know, the other one being pure perception, if you want. Well, language is considered a second-rate way to know things, and the only reliable one is actually direct perception. This is in a nutshell. Of course, there is a lot of things to do about it. The position of the Pratyabhijna, influenced by Bhartrihari, is precisely the opposite. We can do anything without language, actually, and any kind of cognition that we entertain is basically conceptual, and it is for this reason related to language.
Our cognitions are inherently conceptual, which entails that they are inherently linguistic. And you've been mentioning, so let me make a connection here and you can tell me if this is where you want to go. You've been mentioning Bhartrihari as being important here, and he is a grammarian. And so this is, you know, the language channel. I think our listeners would be interested in understanding this thinker in particular and how he's important here in informing what's going on in Upaladeva and in Abhinavagupta. So he is one of those who argues for a close connection between language and our conceptions. Can you say a little bit more about his arguments there and then be able to bring us to understanding of what's going on in Upaladeva and Abhinavagupta that way?
Absolutely. Yes. Bhartrihari is probably, it wasn't probably the only one, he's certainly the most well-known figure in Indian philosophy, stating that any cognitive episode is basically based on language. And this is a clear influence on Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta, which used Bhartrihari's argument as a tool to counter the Buddhist attack, the Buddhist criticism of the notion of self. Now, the thing that I basically argue in this book does not concern this relationship in itself, because the fact that Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta knew Bhartrihari very well, was already established by scholarship before me, and from quite a long time, I would say, one century more or less. So what I wanted to do in this book is not just to notice some general similarities between the two sides, but to show that the influence of Bhartrihari is actually working on a very specific point. And there are also other points in which the Pratibhinya philosophers do not follow Bhartrihari at all. Now, the point, according to my analysis, the point in which Bhartrihari's philosophy, Bhartrihari's thought, is really important is actually in the conception of consciousness. So the two sides, so Bhartrihari on the one hand and the Pratibhinya philosophers on the others, share the idea that mental states are conscious because they are the content of an activity of conceptualization of mind that is inherently linguistic. So in general, what we have, so we have mental states that are about external objects, first order mental states, which the Pratibhinya authors call often prakasha, meaning simply light or cognition, and higher order mental states that make the first ones conscious, which are called in the Pratibhinya works vimarsha, meaning reflection or conceptualization even. And these latter are precisely conceptual, and being conceptual, they are based on language. And this, as I argue in the book, looks like similar to the so-called higher order theories of consciousness that are defended by some contemporary theorists in contemporary philosophy of mind. Now, how do the Indian thinkers argue for this picture, for this two-tier level of consciousness in a way? Now, to make it very short, they believe that a cognition is true if and only if one can successfully act on its basis. So the criterion for truth for them is essentially pragmatic, differently from other schools and other traditions who defended different criterions of truth, for truth. Then, after having said that, they go on by saying that in order to act, to really act, one needs a coordination of mental states that is possible only if these mental states that are directed at the external objects, so the first order mental states, can be coordinated only if they can be syntactically connected. And they call this syntactical connection with a quite interesting Sanskrit word, anusandhana, that they regard as a sort of putting things together according to a certain order. Could be a not very literal translation, but trying to express the sense of this word. And they regard this activity of coordination as the fundamental feature of consciousness. This is the starting point, in a way, because Bhartrihari more or less stops here, and it gives the basics. Then the Kashmiri holders go farther, because they introduce into the picture at least other two crucial concepts, I think, that I have discussed in a couple of chapters of the book, which are the notion of chamatkara, which is another interesting Sanskrit word meaning wonder or something similar, and then also what I think is a panpsychist perspective. Why did they do that? I mean, compared to Bhartrihari, probably because they need to explicitly defend a strong notion of self from the Buddhist criticism, something in which Bhartrihari was not interested. Also because, I didn't say it explicitly, but between Bhartrihari and the Shaiva philosophers, there is a a gap, a temporal gap of at least 4 centuries, and a lot, as you know, happened in between.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see if we can sharpen this, or I'll try and sharpen it for myself at least, with an example. So if I'm understanding you correctly, we have these cognitions of the world. So I might look at a book, and I have a perceptual cognition of that book. But in order for me to act and engage with the book, like to give it to someone to pick it up and things like that, I need to have a second order awareness of that first state, that awareness of the physical object. And that's the level at which language fits into the picture, that I have to have something like a concept of a book, a concept of the things that I am engaging with. Is that a rough, correct picture?
Yes, it is. With just an addition, the point is that these two phases that you have very well described should happen basically instantaneously. Because one of the other points that the Pratyabhijna philosophers derive from Bhartriyari's work is precisely the idea that you cannot treat a cognition as a content of cognition. So there can be a cognition of a cognition. This means that you cannot say in that explicit way that a cognition is acting over another cognition. The picture, and this is something that I have also connected to some contemporary philosophers, the idea seems to be that these two phases happens at the same time. So a mental state is at the same time directed at an object, but is also able to, so it has intentionality, but it is also able at the same time to create a higher order cognition of itself. This is roughly the idea, I think.
Gotcha. So in contrast to a temporal sequence in which we have a slightly later cognition, which takes a previous cognition as its content, we have in some way two aspects of the cognition, one which is object directed and one which is directed at the cognition itself.
Exactly. I wouldn't be able to put it better.
Okay, good. So then, one question then that arises: I'm perceiving this book, and I have a cognition of the book, and I have an awareness, a sort of linguistic awareness of the book. What's going on linguistically there? Am I thinking about this in English? Is Bhartrihari thinking about this in Sanskrit? Is there some other language that's deeper than either of these that's underlying our concept? What's going on there for Bhartrihari?
Well, this is a very good question, and I don't know if I can speak for Bhartrihari in a way, because probably he doesn't say anything so specific about it, but I understand your question is a very compelling one. So generally speaking, and this is also true for contemporary philosophers, you can argue for, I mean, a strict relationship between language and thought, let's put it this way, by arguing that the language that we are talking about in this relationship, of course, is a natural language. So it can be Sanskrit in this way. Or you can, I mean, intend this relationship in a slightly weaker fashion, by introducing the notion of a language of thought, which is not, as you know, directly related, or does not cannot be identified with a natural language at first. So in the book, I've also tried to see whether Bhartrihari was intending one thing or another. And actually, I don't have a straightforward answer, because I have made the hypothesis that Bertrieri may have had in mind something similar to a language of thought. Now, the point is that I have to return to what I said at the beginning. The idea was to interpret these works by, with the help, if you want, of conceptions and tools from contemporary philosophy, but at the same time, sticking to the text. So what I am saying now is not clearly stated in the text. So I cannot be sure whether Bertrieri was defending a language of thought. I'm not sure at all. But one can surmise something like that analyzing one of the most famous contributions Bertrieri gave to classical Indian philosophy, let's call it the way. So the idea that language is not just an audible phenomenon, so made of concrete sound, so the one that we are using now, but is something more. And so quite famously, at least for us working on these things, he put forward the idea that language is divided, can be classified into three or perhaps four different levels. So the first level, as I mentioned a few seconds ago, is the one that we use when we speak, like now. And the second level, which he simply calls intermediate level, looks quite similar to the language of thought that has been introduced in contemporary philosophy, because it is a language that occurs in the mind, even if it keeps having a syntactical structure and a temporal sequence. This is the second level. Then you have a third level in which everything is reduced in a way from a temporal perspective, because you don't have temporality any longer. You have, an instantaneous flash of understanding, which corresponds to this third level. So in the Vakyapadiya, which is the name of Bertrieri's masterpiece, this treatise on sentence and word, you have just explicitly mentioned these three levels, even if some scholars have hypothesized that perhaps there is also a fourth one that would correspond to, we could say, pure consciousness. Because at that level, you don't have intentionality any longer. So to put it simply, I mean, to give a concrete example, I have a pen in front of me as soon as I convey, as soon as I speak this sentence, as I utter this sentence, that would be the first level. But at the same time, the same sentence can exist in my mind having that precise sequence. But at the same time, and that would be the third level, the idea I have a pen in front of me is an instantaneous mental state. And then, if you want, you can add further and final level in which you have just the fact of being conscious without an object. That could be an interpretation of this thing. So what is Bertrieri defending? Is he defending a relationship between natural language and thought, or a language of thought? It is really difficult to tell. Probably, I mean, the easiest way, even if it's more complicated to defend from a philosophical point of view, the most natural answer would be to say no, he's really meaning a natural language, Sanskrit. And let me just say this, and then I'll leave it to you, but even if it's complicated, some contemporary philosophers try to defend the notion that in order to have thought, you need a natural language, which is a quite strong proposition. Davidson is also this time the one to mention.
Right. Good. So let's see if we can shift gears a bit from Bhartrihari to his connections to Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta. So if I'm understanding you correctly, what we have here is that Bartrahari is giving us these sort of major ideas about the aspects of our consciousness involving these higher order representations, which are linguistic in their nature, and that there's evidence in our acting, the way that we engage with the world, that we must have some kind of putting together, the pratisamdhana that you're talking about, or anusamdhana. And these are things which Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta are drawing from Bartrahari, and they're doing this in order, at least in part, to argue that there is some kind of deep self, this some self which you're saying is in opposition to the Buddhist viewpoint, where what we have is something, you know, momentary consciousness, which is not unified by some underlying self. So let's turn to Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta and their understanding of the self. You mentioned panpsychism as one way of understanding what they're after. And you've also mentioned this really important idea, chamatkara, which is often translated as wonder. So first of all, have I got things right? And second of all, what is it that Abhinavagupta and Utpaladeva are arguing for about the self?
As I argued at the very beginning of our conversation, one can defend the notion that we can be conscious without admitting the existing of a subject of experience, of a self. Now, the notion of personhood and self has extensively been criticized by the Buddhists, as I said before, and as we know, and that probably would be the main contribution, perhaps, of the Buddhists to the philosophical debate of classical India. And one also should keep in mind that contemporary Euro-American philosophers tend to be skeptical about the classical view of self that was, defended in Western philosophy since the time of Plato, that posits a subject of experience that is able to do some specific things, which has some specific features, and that, for instance, remains persistent over time, over one's lifetime, for instance. Now, these ideas are more or less, have been superseded by more advanced, if you want, conception of what a self is. Now, coming to our Indian holders, as I probably mentioned before, Bartrahari is not particularly interested in this question. I mean, in the question of proving that there is a self able to do this and that and with specific characteristics. He takes it for granted, basically. Whereas Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta are much more concerned with the question because their first purpose is apologetic. They have to try to demonstrate that not only there is a consciousness, a pure consciousness, having the characteristics that we have identified a few minutes ago, but that there is something more, that there is a subject of experience that is able, for instance, to persist over one's lifetime. And as you were rightly pointing out, to understand how Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta managed, or at least attempted, to demonstrate the existence of a self, we have to take care to discuss a little bit this quite mysterious notion of chamatkara, or wonder, and this idea that is an interpretation of mine. I have to say it. This idea of panpsychism as as a good description, I think, of what the Shaivas had in mind. So, what is chamatkara? Let me start with this notion. So, in order to understand the interpretation I give of this concept, we have to say something about very briefly, of course, about contemporary theories of mind. Now, most theorists nowadays, defend some form of so-called naturalism. So the idea is that conscious mental states depend or are reducible to physical properties of the brain, and finally to atoms and even beyond. Now, there are various currents within, various trends within naturalism. Some of them are more strictly physicalist, other less. But what is interesting to us now is that there are also contemporary theories that oppose in one way or another naturalism. And they usually argue that conscious states cannot be normalized, that is the word they used, meaning that they cannot be reduced to physical properties. Why? First, because we don't know, and this is true, I mean, we don't know, at least yet, how to explain the passage from the physical to the mental. And second, because mental states have a qualitative dimension that is purely subjective and which cannot be explained from a third-person perspective, so from an objective perspective. So, for instance, me and you could observe, you and I could observe the same sunrise, but what is like to be, that is the motto of these thinkers, the what is like to be dimension of seeing this sunrise will never be the same between me and you. There will be always a subjective component in this experience. Now, what I argue in the book, what I suggest in the book, is that this idea is similar to a concept which is used by the Pratyabhidnya philosophers, as well as by others writing in the field of Indian aesthetics, that is chamatkara or wonder, as we already said. Now, what I have done in a chapter of this book is I went through the occurrences of this word in the works of Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta, and it seems to me that the notion is clearly pointing at the qualitative, purely subjective dimension of all cognition. Now, if this is true, I mean, if it is true that cognitions have a qualitative, purely subjective dimension, well, then the Buddhist criticism of self is already, I wouldn't say disproved, because it is not, but it is already attenuated. Because the question in that case for the Buddhist would be, to whom this qualitative aspect of experience belong? So the Pratyabhidnya holders have an answer, because they would reply, oh, okay, it belongs to consciousness. So they have an answer, but it is not a totally satisfactory one, because also from their point of view, the problem is not resolved, because pure consciousness, as I said before, is something that is different from personhood. And for instance, if you argue in favor of a single unitary consciousness, well, you are at risk, for instance, of imagining an enormous self that embraces everything, and this would lead to what philosophers call solipsism, so the idea that a self, that there is only myself in the universe. So, and this is quite, counterintuitive. Or you can end up with saying, okay, pure consciousness is equal to the self. But then in that case, you would have an idea, a conception of the self that is strongly attenuated. And it starts to become quite different, quite difficult to tell the difference between what is a self and what is not, because pure consciousness cannot have that kind of features that I referred to before and that usually are attributed to a self, which I have mentioned in a book and relating to a previous work of Jonardhan Ganeri on this aspect. Now, I think that the Pratyabhidnya's possible way out of this conundrum, so between solipsism and disembodiment or attenuation, lies in the panpsychist outlook of their philosophy, in a way. So what do I mean? So panpsychism is a quite hot, I would say, perspective in contemporary philosophy of mind. So shortly, the panpsychism holds that there is a conscious component that exists in matter. And this component exists at very micro level, so at the atomic level or even beyond that. Now, the position is quite contentious, but is also promising from a theoretical point of view. Why? Because their supporters believe that through panpsychism, one can avoid the problems one encounters by endorsing either naturalism or the opposite view that is usually called property dualism, which is the position according to which mind and matter are not substantially different. So there is no difference in terms of substance between matter and mind, but they do keep having different properties. If you say that they are completely different things, then you have Cartesian dualism. That's another possibility, but it's really quite hard to defend. So why is it panpsychism regarded as a better solution by its supporters? Well, because it does not have to explain how one passes from the physical to the mental, as naturalism should, since panpsychism believes that consciousness, so the mental, is already there. And also because it is not a form of dualism in which you, in the end, postulate that there are two different things in the universe. And it is also can lead to problems. Now, a panpsychist perspective can be, of course, criticized. Criticism, not particularly compelling, is to ridicule the idea that an atom or a quark is conscious. But this does not lead us very far, actually, since, I mean, we all know that there are a lot of true, real things that are far from being commonsensical. And there is, in any case, a more compelling criticism that is important and that is problematic for panpsychism, because panpsychism has to explain how you can pass from a conscious microstate to a conscious macro state. So, to put it very shortly, how do we move and how can we move from a conscious micro state or micro subject, if you want, to a conscious micro one, up to the point of having selves? Now, this is not the occasion to discuss these things, but what I would like to draw the attention on is that the Pratyabhinyas texts are explicitly saying something quite similar. Because they say that consciousness is everywhere. And they explicitly, Utpaladeva literally says that if a rock were not conscious in itself, then no subject would be able to experience it. Usually, in our hermeneutical efforts, these affirmations are not taken quite literally, but metaphorically, in the sense that, okay, yes, it is true, but he means that Shiva is everywhere and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, I've made an effort to take them literally and to see what happens. What happens, I think, is that perhaps paying attention to this aspect can be helpful to understand how you can pass from pure consciousness to a more developed notion of self, which is the main problem of the Pratyabhijna. Now, to round it off, what is the solution in a way? So, according to these authors, even if we cannot expect a very detailed argumentation, but what they seem to mean is that the difference that exists between a rock and a human subject is explained in terms of the level of complexity of the micros, of the micro-conscious items. So, in a way, a human subject will have a quite more complex arrangement of micro conscious states compared to a rock or other less complex beings in a way. So these I've also related this thing to the 36 tattvas of which are important in the Shaiva literature. That could be a metaphorical, if you want, way to state these different levels of complexity. So,
Let me try and put a point on what you've been saying, so make sure I've got it. So, sorry, hang on just one second. I think I have a bit of an echo here. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, perfectly.
Okay, great. I'll cut that out. Okay. So for Abhinavagupta, a rock is going to have some kind of consciousness, but it's not going to have the same kind of maybe cognitive activity that a human being does. It's not going to think about other rocks. It's not going to think about itself as a rock. It's not going to have some kind of special rock language, which is maybe a sort of caricature of a panpsychist view that someone might have here, which is, well, if consciousness involves something conceptual and something linguistic, then why not posit that rocks are, you know, speaking rock language and have these kinds of cognitions. What you're saying is that for him, he distinguishes between different aspects of cognition. We have these direct cognitions of things, and we have this higher order cognition of that gives rise to consciousness. We have a subjective aspect to our cognizing, what it's like to see the thing. And then we have our self, which is underlying all of this cognitive activity. So of those aspects, what does a rock have and what does a rock not have?
So this is a quite interesting answer. Sorry, a quite interesting question. I was thinking about the answer that is difficult for me to give. So the basic idea seems to be that these, subjective side must be present really anywhere. So the point is, as I said, is a matter of complexity and a matter of having items in the world which has simply because they are so have a different level of consciousness sophistication. It could be a way to put it. Now, there is no argumentation, or I could even say that this is something that I would really love to go into the details, because probably something else could pop up in order to corroborate this idea. But from a theological and religious point of view, they would simply say that the level of manifestation of Shiva is much higher in a human subject than in lower beings or lower entities, but it is always there. That's their point. I think it's also this panpsychist perspective, it's not a question whether it is there or not, because they say it explicitly, but the way in which we can understand it, of course, is another question. But this perspective could be also useful to address the question that I mentioned before, so the charge of solipsism. If you say that there is just one pure consciousness, what is the difference between me and you? And usually this is quite problematic, and the Pratyabhijna holders were aware of the problem, and they try to come up with a solution which is not particularly, which is interesting from the point of view of the history of philosophy, but it's not particularly compelling in terms of arguments, because what they say is basically we don't perceive another another person, but we guess its existence. And so playing with the pramanas, so with the ways of knowing, and so in a way giving also in this way by saying that I do not perceive another person, but I guess his or her existence, I am in a way saying that what is really important is my own consciousness. So the subjective perspective remains more important. But if you, try to see this question with from the perspective of a panpsychist view, you can say that actually they were aware of the fact that there are other persons in the universe and that we are not alone. But it is also this aspect is connected to a different level of complexity or I don't know how to say it explicitly, but in terms of a highest presence of consciousness. I mean, what you experience personally is definitely stronger than what you can surmise for others. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was clear.
Yeah, that's helpful. I think this is fascinating stuff, and I think that there's a lot in these thinkers that could be useful for people who are concerned with questions of panpsychism and philosophy of mind more generally. So in addition to the discussion of language in your book, of course, there's these metaphysical questions about philosophy of mind that I think people would be interested in looking at. And as we've seen, the relationship between the two of them. So thank you for that. Let's close up just by noting what you're working on now. As you've said, there's a lot that you could be working on. What's focusing your attention right now?
Well, okay. So I'm always interested in Bartrieri's hermeneutics, if you want, and also in non-dualistic philosophies in general, and also the Pragyavignan more specifically. But at the moment, I'm actually working on not so related stuff because I'm working on Mimamsa literature, and more specifically, I'm involved in a project that tries to understand the way in which Vedic injunctions are suspended and superseded by other Vedic injunctions within the sacrificial setting, with the idea to understand the relationship between the suspending injunction and the suspended one, and trying to formalize all these things from using the language of contemporary logic. So it's another, if you want, multidisciplinary attempt.
And, yes. Yeah. With a lot on both sides there, both in the Mimamsa literature and in the contemporary work on modals and all of those deontic logic
really,
and things.
Really, fascinating, and I'm really enjoying it. And
that's great. Great. Well, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Great. Thanks, Marco.
Bye.